So welcome everyone to the 10th episode of the Berkeley Institute Live podcast. Today, Professor Ron Hasner joins us to explore the rising trend of states creating fortified boundaries or borders around the world. Professor Ron Hasner will talk about his article, co-written with Professor Jason Wittenberg, called Barriers to Entry, Who Builds Fortified Boundaries and Why? And he'll also delve into the reasons for why states build physical barriers. And in light of COVID-19, he'll also discuss how immigration and borders could be affected by a transnational bordering issue like the coronavirus pandemic. So this episode is part of the Berkeley Institute's live podcast series. Episodes every Tuesday and Thursday engage students and faculty and community on timely topics related to Israel, Jewish law, thought, and identity. Each episode is aired live and is followed by an interactive Q&A, and all of our past episodes can be found on our website. So I'm going to introduce our speaker today. Professor Ron Hasner is the Chancellor's Professor of Political Science and Helen Diller Family Chair in Israel Studies. His research explores the role of ideas, practices, and symbols in international security, with particular attention to the relationship between religion and violence. He holds a PhD in political science and a Master's in Religious Studies from Stanford University, and an MIA, Master in International Affairs from Columbia University. He's also the co-faculty director of the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. So welcome, Ron. We're really excited to have you here today. How are you doing? How's the, you know, this new life been going for you over the past couple of weeks?
I really can't complain. I happen to be locked in with people I really, really like, and we still have 3 rolls of toilet paper left. So we're super happy.
And we'd love to hear just briefly how it's been in terms of work. How has your reality shifted teaching and working on a campus where usually so much of our work is done?
So it has to shift quite rapidly. I have 2 classes this semester. One is a class called War in the Middle East, which has 120 students in it. What I've done there is because sessions with 120 students are often difficult to conduct in terms of the quality of the communication, I've been recording my lectures every week so students can listen to those as high quality recordings, and then have had just open Q&A with the students twice a week. Students also meet with their teaching, with my teaching assistants twice a week. So that's gone pretty well. Classes and moving apace with guest speakers and lectures on a whole range of topics. And I'm also teaching a small seminar that has 20 students in it, which is a intensive research and writing seminar. And we just meet via Zoom every week and have 2-hour conversations and go back and forth on topics related to religion and conflict. So it's required a good deal of adjustment, and working from home can be hard when your son plays the trumpet and your daughter plays the clarinet. But it works. So far it works. It's very, very hard for the students. Very hard, and particularly emotionally, I think.
Definitely. So today we're going to talk about your article, which talks a lot about fortified boundaries or barriers around the world, talking about the conditions under which they're constructed and whether they're effective. Could you just share, first of all, what the definition is for the boundaries that you're talking about, and then just a bit of background about some recent trends that you have been following?
Gladly. So this is this was a piece that I envisioned together with my colleague Jason Wittenberg, who sits on our academic board at the Institute. Jason and I were troubled by all sorts of instances in which the study of Israeli security is studied out of context in relationship to how other countries face similar issues. So there was a trend for a while of sort of Israeli exceptionalism. And there is now, I think, a growing trend of looking at Israel as one case among many, which is what international politics scholars are supposed to do. Comparing across similar instances to see how different states respond in similar situations. So just as one shouldn't study, I don't know, Israeli Air Force technology without comparing it to NATO or Egypt or Australia, our thinking was that the physical barriers that Israel had constructed, especially along its border with Gaza and along its border with the West Bank, although those are not the only ones, we're in no way different or unique compared to other such barriers that other countries had built. And I'll say in a minute exactly about which kinds of barriers we're interested in. We had an intuition that other examples existed. It was not clear to us until we actually engaged a team of research assistants that there were 50 examples around the world when we wrote our article 5 years ago. By now, the number's gone up to somewhere between 70 and 80. All cases that are very, very similar to Israel's West Bank barrier. Of course, there's a whole agenda that's designed to make the Israeli barrier stand out like a sore thumb and treat it as an anomaly. So these are the kind of people who talk about it as, you know, an apartheid wall or as some sort of extraordinary Israeli enterprise. But it turns out that not only is it common, but it is particularly common in the Middle East. Okay, so what kinds of barriers are we talking about? Most countries have some sort of demarcation along their border, some sort of fence or posts. Sometimes it's just a stone, an inscribed stone that's set into the wilderness somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Increasingly, what we're noticing, and in very rapidly growing numbers, states are building fortifications along their borders that are strong enough to keep out individuals or small groups of people, not quite big enough to keep out armies. So when Jason and I started collecting information on fortified barriers, we were not referring to the Great Wall of China or the border between North and South Korea, you know, where there are minefields and anti-tank obstacles and machine gun nests essentially obstacles designed to make it impossible for armor or a large military invasion to take place. We're talking about something more modest. We're talking about usually some combination of brick, metal, fence. Sometimes there are some ditches. Often there's barbed wire. Often there's some sort of monitoring mechanism. It's something that you could with great ease drive through if you had a tank. In fact, it's something that you could with relatively ease climb over, but it would take you a while. And the purpose of these barriers is not to stop the movements of individuals. The purpose of these barriers is to slow down the movement of individuals and make that movement visible. So the most obvious example that comes to mind, maybe two examples that come to mind, are the Berlin Wall, which again, were not designed to stop NATO forces from invading Eastern Europe. They were designed to prevent individuals from crossing from East Berlin to West Berlin. And the other obvious example is the US-Mexico barrier, which again is not designed to prevent the Mexican army from invading. It's not even designed to prevent an organized military force, say Mexican insurgents or Mexican drug cartels. I think they could easily, with a large truck, ram through it. Instead, it's designed to prevent individual infiltrators. So it has a law enforcement purpose. Our goal was threefold. First of all, we wanted a list, and that list is in the paper. Second, we wanted to understand what the motivations were of the states that were building them, because we had some idea in our head of what Israel's motivations were, and we wanted to see if other states had similar motivations. And third, we wanted to know if it worked. And if you're curious, I will answer those questions. Otherwise, I'll keep the answers to myself.
Thanks, Ron. My next question was one of those questions. Maybe we'll work our way through them all. But I'm curious if you could elaborate just a little bit more. You noted the kind of more general goals of avoiding infiltrators, but what would kind of the agendas or the reasons that people might have these goals be? What would be some reasons that walls could be, that borders could be fortified?
So we had no preconceptions about this. We had some hunches. But mainly, we asked our research team, which consisted of multiple grad students, to just collect every shred of information they could about these barriers. Who built them? How long were they? What materials were they made out of? And then we started collecting information on the countries that built the barriers and the countries against which the barriers were built, right? So the assumption is they're countries or territories on both sides. We collected characteristics of builders and characteristics of targets. And because we're good social scientists and not rookies, we were careful to collect data not just on states that built barriers, but also on states that could have built barriers and didn't. In other words, we collected data on each and every contiguous border in the world. In total, let me look up, I wrote it down somewhere. We had 635 borders on which barriers could have been built. So there could be a barrier on the border between Syria and Iraq. There could be a barrier on the border between Syria and Lebanon. There could be a barrier on the border between Syria and Turkey, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because we wanted to see how the pairs in which borders were fortified were different from the pairs in which borders were not. So the first thing we look for in the data is, do countries that build these barriers, are they often involved in territorial disputes? And are they trying to use those barriers perhaps in order to demarcate where they would like their territory to be, so that these barriers are used as land grabs? And the answer is that does not seem to be a salient pattern in the data. That doesn't address the issue of Israel, by the way. It just means that in the data, across our 70 cases, there is no distinction between the 70 cases that built barriers and the 600 cases that didn't in terms of territorial disputes. So that's suspicion number one. Suspicion number two, are countries that build barriers prone to terrorist attacks? And are they perhaps building these barriers by and large in order to defend themselves from terrorism? And that also turned out to be not the case. By and large, that was not the pattern. So we kept looking for patterns because we're social scientists and we're just desperate for patterns. Whether they exist or not, we're gonna find them. And we ended up finding two patterns, one of which was surprising and the other one was very, very surprising. The surprising pattern was that rich countries tend to build them against poor countries, which immediately creates the suspicion that these barriers are designed not so much to keep out terrorists, but perhaps to keep out immigrants, smugglers, drug traffickers. So they serve an economic purpose. And that's maybe surprising. I think it's fascinating, mainly fascinating. Surprise number two cropped up in the data. So we asked all sorts of questions like, do democracies tend to build them against non-democracies? Nope. Is it small countries against big countries? Nope. Is it, Western countries against non-Western countries? Nope. So pattern number two, it turns out that the targets, in other words, the countries on the other side of the barrier, are predominantly Muslim. That was quite surprising. And then even more surprising was the fact that the countries that build the barriers are predominantly Muslim. Overwhelmingly so. More than half the cases. So there's a real barrier building tendency by Muslim countries against other Muslim countries, and we can't quite explain why. Because it doesn't seem to correlate necessarily with terrorism. It might correlate with insurgency. It might correlate with instability. But a lot of these countries are wealthy oil-producing countries in the Gulf and in the Arabian Peninsula, walling themselves up from poorer neighbors. There is no such tendency in Latin America. So oil does not seem to by itself explain the construction of these barriers. It's a combination of wealth and it's a combination of Islam. I'm going to stop there.
So I have a follow-up. I was actually, as you were speaking, thinking of the Latin American case, but I'm curious if are there any possible kind of factors that could lead into that, such as the history in that region, or maybe kind of an arms race of borders, like if one puts up a border, is it kind of a contagion effect?
Yes, there's definitely contagion effect, which I'm very interested in because I'm very interested in sort of the sociology of international politics. Contagion effect, meaning just that it spreads from country to country, and it spreads from country to country at an ever-growing pace. And I can show that. I'll pull up a little image from the paper, which we will also put online. Let me share this with you, so those of you who are watching the video can see it. This is figure number one in the paper. And you can see here, the line shows the total length, and you can see a leap from the 1990s to the 2000s. And the bars show the number of barriers. And again, we're going from 6 barriers in the 70s, another 11 barriers in the 80s, and then in the 2000s, 17 new barriers constructed. And since then, the number has grown, has essentially doubled since we finished writing the paper. So that's what we mean by contagion, that it's spreading from country to country and it's spreading fast. So we see two kinds of contagion effects, although that topic I think needs to be explored further. Contagion effect number one, and I'm trying to steer away from COVID conversation here, but since you've used the word contagion, it comes to mind, and that is the number of barriers is growing. And it's not just growing, it is it's growing exponentially. So there's a real trend around the world in building these barriers. If, you know, perhaps 10, 20 years ago, it was possible to point at Israel and say, how dare you? That's becoming an increasingly untenable position around the world, and especially an increasingly untenable position in the Middle East. They are now ubiquitous. They're everywhere. So that's contagion number one. And contagion number two is they tend to sprout up in neighborhoods. So India builds one against Pakistan, then Pakistan retaliates, builds one on its side of the border against India, then Pakistan builds another one on its other border with Afghanistan. Afghanistan builds one on its border with Iran. They tend to spread by geographical contiguity. What I would like to know most is I'd like to know about the virus. I would like to know about the companies that build these things. They tend to be technologically quite sophisticated. They are not walls. I should have probably said that in the beginning. These do not tend to be walls. Walls make for very bad border barriers, which is why Israel's West Bank, quote unquote, wall is not wall at all. Less than 10% of it is wall. Walls make for bad barriers because you can't see through them. You can't see who's coming. They are brittle. They're actually easier to destroy than large systems of fences. They're easier to dig under. And they're hard to move, and often these barriers need to be somewhat mobile. You sometimes want to fence off this area, at other times you want to fence off another area. So mostly these tend to be fences, sophisticated fences. I would love to have information on the international corporations that build these fences, because I suspect that they are one of the carriers of the virus. In other words, that the way a far-flung country like Uruguay learns how to build an efficient barrier is by hiring a Chinese company that built the Israeli barrier or that built the Saudi barrier. And I know in some cases that some of the same companies are involved because I see the same technology cropping up in place after place. But states are very, very secretive about these projects. They don't share statistics. We had to dig pretty deep in order to get at our numbers.
So the next question that would follow is probably, did you find, if in your research, did you study whether or not these walls have been effective to address those goals that they were kind of built to accomplish?
So that was the original title of the paper. It was called Barriers to Entry, Who Builds International Barriers and Do They Work? And we had to drop the second part of the title, because it turns out to be an almost impossible social science question to answer. So here's a quick 30 second primer on which social science questions can you answer and which can't. How effective a barrier is requires a counterfactual. Before Rebecca prompts me, I'm going to explain what a counterfactual is. Counterfactual is it requires you to imagine a universe in which the thing you're studying did not happen. So in order to answer the question, is the barrier that, say, Morocco, the most impressive barrier in our set, is a barrier that Morocco built in the middle of the Sahara Desert. It's about 2,000 miles long. So it is massively, massively longer than any barrier Israel has ever attempted. It ate up 70% of Morocco's gross domestic product when it was built. It's in the middle of the Sahara. It's the most hostile territory in the world. It's massive. You can see it like in aerial images. It's enormous. So did it work? The goal was to prevent Sahrawi insurgents from entering into Morocco. In order to know whether that barrier is effective, I have to imagine a parallel universe in which the barrier was not built and ask myself how many insurgents would have then entered Morocco. And that's very hard to do because I don't know how many are trying to enter and are stopped by the barrier. Morocco won't tell me. Like last week we arrested 17 people, the week before we arrested 20. So the states are not sharing that information. I also don't know how many people are deterred by the mere existence of the barrier from even trying. So here's one obvious factoid, which I think most of you are familiar with. There was a significant series of suicide attacks from the West Bank into Israel prior to the construction of the West Bank barrier. By the time half of the barrier was complete, the suicide attacks stopped cold. I mean, went down to zero and have stayed at zero since the completion of, the barrier is not even complete. How do I know that that is thanks to the barrier? I don't. I just don't. There are some clues that I can glean that might support my hypothesis. So for example, as the West Bank barrier was being constructed, its construction started in the Netanya area, the area east of Netanya, for good reason. That is where the distance between the West Bank and the Mediterranean Sea is the narrowest. As those parts of the barrier started going up, the distribution of suicide attacks shifted away from Netanya, which was suicide attack central, into Afula. And then the barrier started going up in Afula, and the suicide attack stopped in Afula, and they started shifting to other areas. And there are some good quotes from Palestinian terror leaders saying, boy, it's getting hard to get into Israel. We have to take indirect routes. So that's some evidence. It's not super consistent evidence, and it's not hard enough for me to say barriers work. I have my own intuition on this issue. If your standard for what counts as work is this barrier must stop anyone from crossing ever, then the answer is no, barriers don't work. People will climb over them, people will dig under them, people will find ways around them. If your standard is, does this barrier slow people down so that I can see them and if possible arrest them, then I think the answer is yes. These barriers work because one tendency that all humans have in common is they cannot walk through walls. It does slow people down. There's a famous barrier that Spain built around some territories that it has in Morocco. It's a very, very sophisticated barrier funded by the European Union. So while the European Union is over here castigating Israel for its barrier, it was funding to the tunes of many millions of euros a series of barriers to protect Moroccans from going into Spanish colonies in Morocco. And there was a moment at which almost 1,000 Moroccans stormed that barrier and started climbing over it. And they broke the barrier. They were all then arrested and sent back to Morocco. So in that sense, the barrier fulfills its purpose. Is that a moral or an ethical purpose? I have no opinion on that. I'm not a moralist. I'm a political scientist. But by and large, the barriers seem to fulfill the purpose. I'll say one last sentence about this because I'm talking too much. If these barriers were seen by world leaders as being inefficient, I don't think we would have seen the trend of contagion that we're seeing. So I would be surprised in seeing the number of barriers leap from 50 barriers in 2015 to now we're getting close to 100 barriers in 2020. I would be surprised if that kind of trend took off while everyone thinks that these barriers are useless. Now, useless, useful for what? Maybe they're useful as a way for leaders to dupe their voters into thinking, I'm doing something assertive, maybe. So maybe they're just useful for propaganda. But there are some reasons to think that they have at least partial efficacy.
Thank you. So that kind of transitions into another question. So as you alluded to, I think in the U.S. we've heard a lot of conversations about the U.S.-Mexico border and building a wall, and in other places around the world, there's been a lot of conversations and a lot of frustration over these kinds of things, as well as a lot of support. I'm curious if you found that there are any kind of unintended consequences that might arise, or other goals, or other kind of consequences beyond the goals that were intended.
Yeah, so great question. So one consequence, it used to be loss of legitimacy. So, and the Berlin Wall, I think, is a fantastic example of this, right? Everybody looked at the Berlin Wall and said to themselves, wow, right? These East Germans actually have to build a wall in order to keep their citizens in their country. That doesn't seem to be a very nice country then. And I think Israel encountered some of these legitimacy concerns early on. Now that it's becoming a global trend, it's very, very hard to make that kind of anti-legitimacy claim, right? I mean, who doesn't now have a fortified barrier, especially in Europe? Europe is now crisscrossed by these barriers, most of which are intended to keep out Syrian refugees. It's Greece, it's Hungary, it's Romania, it's Germany, it's Austria. They're all across Europe. It's an entire network. Other unintended consequence, if people really want to get across, they're going to get across some way. If their purpose is to get in and they can't get across the border, they might take a flight, they might take a boat, they might risk their lives and traverse very dangerous territory. So that's certainly the case on the U.S.-Mexico border. If their purpose is to get in order to kill, which was the purpose of the Palestinian border crossing, once you close off that border with barriers so that people can't come in to kill anymore, they're going to find some other way to kill. So in the Palestinian case, the construction of a fortified barrier along the border with Gaza stopped suicide bombing completely, brought it to just a standstill, almost stopped kidnappings completely, and Hamas switched to rockets. That is in the nature of military defense. As soon as the rockets started raining down, Israel developed an anti-rocket system. Now, presumably, there are very smart people in Hamas who are trying to figure out some alternative, and Israel will figure out an alternative response to that, and the cat and mouse game is going to continue forever. So barriers are not the last word. They are merely a response and a move, and they often then lead the other side to take some countermeasure.
So as we talk about contagion and with a different meaning, I do want to bring it back a little bit to the current crisis and to think about some of the connections there. So it's a really interesting moment to think about borders and boundaries on a more global scale. You could say that there's been some kind of global failure of collaboration around combating the virus. Everyone's kind of been focusing on their own nations and borders. And at the same time, this is something that affects us kind of and affects neighboring countries in a really, really significant way. So how are you kind of thinking about this again in this current moment?
So I'm in two minds about this. I'll present the two opinions and you can choose from them because I'm not strongly aligned with one or the other. So there has been a trend throughout the last end of the Cold War, I'd say the last 30 years in political science, to say the world is becoming increasingly globalized. It's becoming easier to move from country to country. Countries have more interests in common. Countries have more worries in common. Pollution, immigration, refugees, disease, poverty, spread regardless of borders from country to country. And if the world is smart, the world will learn that we are better off tearing down boundaries and uniting in our efforts. That is the globalized dream. Maybe I was slightly misleading when I said that I don't have a strong opinion on this, because I have a slightly strong opinion on this because that dream has not borne out. There are some, my colleague Wendy Brown in my department is one of them. She's written a wonderful book about barriers like the ones we're talking about today. Using them as emblematic of the decline of the state. And I think that is exactly wrong. I think they are a sign of the triumph of the state. The state is not going anywhere. And if you had thought now more than ever before that states are going to fling their gates open and share technology and share resources and share knowledge and share wisdom, what you are in fact seeing in response to COVID is more entrenchment, more fences, more lockdowns, more competition between countries. I'm not for a second saying it's a good thing. In fact, I'll step out on a limb and I'd say right now, right here, I think that's a bad thing. I have a strong liberal heart pounding in me and I would like to see humanity come together. But not only am I not seeing Americans coming together with Europeans, I'm not even seeing Californians coming together with Texans. I'm seeing barriers going up around communities and around states. I'm seeing barriers going up around neighborhoods. So I think particularly when times are rough, the entrenchment mechanism is strong. Somehow the Israeli-Palestinian case is a bit of an exception because Palestinians and Israelis are really living cheek by jowl. They understand that no barrier, no fence can stem the spread of a disease, because really all it takes is one Israeli with a bad cold crossing over into the West Bank, or one Palestinian with a bad cough going the other way, and it's game over. And that is something fences were never designed to do. They were never designed to hermetically seal off countries. So in the Israeli-Palestinian case, they have, to a large extent, opened up barriers, sharing both treatment, sharing diagnosis centers, sharing technology, coordinating a common front against COVID, not just with the Palestinian Authority, which would have been remarkable enough, but between Israel and Hamas, which is utterly remarkable, because it's clear that a mass pandemic spread inside Gaza or inside any large Palestinian population center, perhaps a Palestinian refugee camp, would be bad for everybody and really, really, really bad. So that's an exception. But around the rest of the world, the barriers are only going up faster. So much for the globalized dream.
And on that note, I think we've run out of time. I have so many other questions for you, but I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ron.